True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
Malcolm Webster drugged and murdered his first wife, and after getting away with it, he tried to do the same to his second wife. A third fiancée, Simone Benarchi, was saved by detectives when they warned her and showed her evidence of her intended's lies and crimes. She was stunned to learn that the man she loved was plotting her death as they were planning their honeymoon together. Webster was an English-born nurse who traveled the world and used drugs to sedate his victims before eliminating evidence with arson and murder. His three best-known victims were women who were independently wealthy and fell for his English gentleman persona. Police believe there were many more victims. He had set ablaze cars, offices, and homes. After gaining access to bank accounts, he embezzled money with forged signatures and fraudulent documents. Even as he spent Simone's fortune and arranged for her death, he had a string of other women he was setting up for future targets. There were many coincidences following Malcolm Webster over the years, too many for police detectives to accept. Though he took everything from the women that he victimized, those who survived would say that Malcolm Webster was gentle. He killed with kindness, putting them into oblivious slumber with drugs before leaving them to fiery deaths. The deliberate widower, Malcolm Webster, is our topic at the quiet end today. The outrageous crimes this man inflicted over his lifetime formulate an incredible, intricate story of a con man who would stop at nothing, even murder, to get the things that he wanted.
So today's beer is a beer from the British Isles. I thought about doing a New Zealand beer, but I went with the British beer because his first wife was from the British Isles. Scotland, actually. But I just chose a British beer. And I have Samuel Smith's Nut Brown Ale, which is brewed by Samuel Smith Old Brewery in Tadcaster, England. Now, it's an English brown ale. This style of beer tends to be malty and sweet, colored reddish-brown to dark brown. It can be fruity or nutty or both, and there's not much hop presence in them. So this particular one is a medium brown color with a moderately sized head. There's kind of a nutty chocolate aroma, and the taste follows the nose exactly. Medium-bodied beer, very easy to drink, and at only 5% alcohol by volume, you could put down a few of these. Good beer.
Sounds great. Let's open it up and go down to the quiet end.
Okay. So remember last week when we were at the quiet end, and you pointed out the couple that looked like they were having their first date?
Yeah, they did leave together, but I don't know how confident I feel.
Well, they're back.
Together?
Together. Oh. Now, the guy's ditched the hat.
And well, that's good.
He's wearing a nice shirt.
Uh-huh.
So, because I remember you were kind of snobbish about him last week, and you were putting him down a little bit. Thinking,
is that snobbish, though? I mean, it's not because I'm a snob. It's just that I think he didn't put the effort in for the date. I don't have anything against baseball hats or sloppy clothing, but it's a first date. Make a little effort, that's all.
Well, he must have done something, because it looks like there's a second date.
Well, that's great.
And maybe she did say to him something.
Sure it's the same woman?
Yeah.
Oh.
Nice-looking lady.
All right. I'll have to look. I know they're behind me, so yeah, I'll look when I get a chance.
Don't turn around.
I won't look now, or point.
No, don't point either.
I won't point.
But okay. That's nice to see.
Yeah, so maybe after the podcast, we should buy them a beer if they're still here.
Yeah.
That'd be cool.
You know, I'm reminded about you and I, actually.
Really?
In the sense that you're so much more attractive and intelligent
please.
Than me.
Oh, God, no.
But I wasn't intimidated. I had confidence.
Oh, okay.
So even though I didn't think I was in your league, I had enough confidence to approach you, and we got to know each other, and here we are.
Well, that stuff's not true, but yes, I believe that confidence is really important.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's the point I'm making, actually.
Right. I might be prettier than you, but I'm not smarter by any means, by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, that's debatable. Anyway.
Okay.
Confidence.
Confidence is important, so take it from Uncle Dick, boys. Confidence will get you far.
That's right.
Yeah.
Don't be thinking that that person is too far above you.
No, that doesn't get you anywhere.
Nope. Go for it.
Absolutely.
All right. Enough editorializing.
Okay.
So Malcolm John Webster was born in London in April of 1959, just minutes after his twin sister, Carolyn. His parents were uptight and seemed cold, but they appeared to be a normal, happy little family. Now, Malcolm's father was Alexander Webster, and he was a detective in charge of the fraud squad at the Metropolitan Police Service in London. Now, Alexander, the father, was born in Scotland to a strict family. So as a result, he was a big, heavy taskmaster who controlled his home life as he controlled his work life.
He was quite intimidating.
He was. He was a big kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think from dealing with criminals for all those years, he could be pretty gruff and intimidating.
I imagine that could do that to you, but it's probably important to have a different attitude at home, which he seemed to have trouble with.
It sure does. So he met Malcolm's mother, Odette, when they both worked as police officers, both in Surrey and in London. They married in 1952. So they had a son they named Ian, followed by the twins Malcolm and Carolyn. Odette, who had worked as a nurse before she became a police officer, became a full-time housewife.
Yeah, now, by all accounts, the Websters kept a strange household. Alexander had some odd habits. Malcolm, his sister and his brother, and Odette had to vacate the family home every time that he had to use the bathroom. So
yeah, this not just to urinate, but, as we say, number two.
When he had to go number two,
we had to clear the house. Or should we say defecate? Does that sound better than number two?
No, that sounds worse.
Okay.
So Daddy, as Malcolm would forever call him, demanded complete privacy for his toilet use. Now, this could happen two or three times a day. It wasn't just like every morning like clockwork either. In the winters, Odette would actually bundle up the children and take them for a walk if he needed to do his thing. And this continued all the way until Malcolm was an adult. Even if he's visiting the house as an adult, this would happen.
Yeah, this is just strange stuff.
So I mean, that's strange.
Is it such a small house that it's a stink bomb going off? Or what do you suppose?
I have no idea. I can't even venture to guess. The children were not allowed to speak at the dinner table either unless they were directly questioned by their father. It was his opinion that he had worked hard all day and he deserved silence as he ate his evening meal.
Must have been a pleasant dinner table, huh?
Yeah. As a child, Malcolm was a loner. He seemed happy enough, but he didn't have many friends. When he tried to get attention from his peers, his behavior was quite odd. He faked numerous medical conditions, he fainted in front of everyone, and he complained of some injuries that just weren't there. By the time he was seven, Malcolm was given the nickname Pyro. Now, this was because he had a fascination with fire, and he would try and impress the other boys by showing off his fire-setting skills. Now, one thing he liked to do was he liked to use nail polish remover to start fires, burning bushes and trash bins in the neighborhood, and he'd been caught doing that a few times.
Yeah. Now, this early fire setting is one of the things that we see in sociopaths as a trait.
Right, yeah.
So that's, looking back, a warning sign, don't you think?
Yes, but I would say that this man's a little different in that he didn't seem to have the outward violence, the, you know, like harming animals. He wasn't brutal. He was more of a secret.
Right.
Secretly evil kind of guy.
He wasn't that secret. He bragged about setting fires to his friends.
Yes, but I mean as far as hurting people.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, or hurting animals. He didn't seem to do that in an outright brutal way like some people we've read about have. That's all I'm saying.
I got you.
Okay.
Malcolm was also thought to have both epilepsy and asthma as a young child, and other boys looked at him as kind of a weakling. He told people he was dyslexic so he could get some sympathy in school and from his parents, who ended up praising him for the smallest of academic accomplishments. So Malcolm the child was much like the adult in how he mimicked emotions he thought would get him attention. His siblings, Ian and Carolyn, were favored by their parents as Malcolm was spending more and more time alone. Now, at school, he told the other kids that he had a brain tumor. So we're starting to get into some more pathology here, don't you think?
Yes, he liked to fake illnesses.
Yeah.
So a little bit of Munchausen, or is that just more hypochondria?
Hypochondria. He wasn't really
making himself sick that we know of.
No.
Okay.
But he was also stealing money from his parents.
Yep.
He often got into trouble, but he had no police record as a juvenile. So he finished school, tried some sales jobs that he failed at, and then he decided to train as a nurse because he had faked so many medical problems that he felt comfortable in the hospital setting. It's a reasonable way to think about things, right?
Sure. And going back to having no police record as a juvenile, I wonder if his father had something to do with that. His father was quite high up in the police and may have protected him.
I think that's a possibility.
Yeah. Malcolm's first girlfriend became pregnant with his child when he was only 15. He asked her to have an abortion, which would be done in a backstreet London clinic. Now, Malcolm worked part-time for the girl's father, and he was fired for stealing from him. So that was the end of that. She did have the abortion. His first love came soon afterward, and she ended up killing herself. The details of her suicide are a bit of a mystery, but it was investigated decades later, and police could find no proof that Malcolm had any part in it or had caused it. But it would not be the only death of a woman that would be connected to Malcolm throughout his life.
Oh, no.
No. Now, after the suicide, Malcolm began an affair with a married woman who was 8 years older than him. According to witnesses from the time, he fell in love with her. It was a passionate affair which ended when she chose to be with her husband. Friends said that Malcolm was really devastated when that relationship ended, and he decided to get away, to travel around.
Reasonable, I think.
Sure. You know,
you're kind of unlucky, right? I mean, his first true love kills herself.
Yes.
And he's been in this passionate affair with a married woman who chooses her husband over him.
Yeah, that wouldn't be pleasant.
No.
I agree.
So he decides he's going to travel, and over the next decade, he traveled to New Zealand, Australia, and the Middle East. Now, once he's back in the British Isles, he told people he worked with Aboriginal children while in the Australian outback and in schools and hospitals in New Zealand before settling into life in the United Arab Emirates. So he was 30 years old when he worked at the Tawam Children's Hospital in Abu Dhabi, but he left after bad circumstances only 6 months into the job. He apparently was being investigated for the unexplained deaths of 3 young children. They were all under 6 years old, and they all died of cardiac failure in a 6-month time span. Now, this is a very unusual death in children.
Explain that a little bit.
Well, cardiac failure is usually the end result of something going on. To make that a diagnosis implies some congenital heart disease or something, none of which these kids had. So the suspicion is that something was done to them that resulted in cardiac failure and death.
Yeah, because these aren't people who are going to have clogged arteries or congestive heart failure. These are kids. So if there's no genetic problem with their heart.
Right, and there's no congenital heart disease, it would be a distinctly unusual cause of death.
Yeah, and I feel like if this happened in current times, it would be investigated more, especially
sure
in the United States or other Western countries.
Yeah. Now, it turns out that each death, Malcolm was the nurse on duty, and he discovered all the children deceased in their beds.
That would set off some red flags.
Wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Now, some difficulty here, the Emirates culture, the body's buried very quickly, and there's no post-mortem exam. That's the custom. So there was no investigation forensically into or pathologically into these kids' deaths. It looks like they just said, get out. They fired them.
I know, but isn't that odd? Wouldn't you think they'd make in special circumstances where there could be a murder that they would have done autopsies?
Apparently not.
It's very strange. Beth Brown, who worked with Malcolm, and she was actually his lover at the time, said that there was an inquiry by health officials, and he was definitely suspected. And he was fired just hours after the third child had died.
Yeah, so they're looking at him closely, right?
It kind of seems like they knew it was him. I'm surprised that nothing else was done. There were several strange incidences leading up to these deaths. Malcolm was found semi-conscious after experimenting with self-injection of insulin, and hospital administrators suspected he had injected the children as well. But rather than a police investigation, Malcolm was escorted out of the country. Investigations would later reveal that Alexander Webster, Malcolm's dad, had used foreign staff office connections to help Malcolm, and he paid for his flight home. When he was safely back in the UK, he began working again as a nurse in Surrey, and that's when he met his first wife, Claire. Claire was born in 1961 to a birth mother who'd gotten pregnant with the wrong guy at the wrong time. Dr. Charlie Morris and his wife Betty adopted Claire after Betty learned that she couldn't get pregnant, so she was very wanted. 18 months later, Claire was joined by a baby brother named Pete, who was also adopted. Her childhood was very close to ideal. This was a very loving, well-to-do household. Charles was a surgeon, and Betty stayed home with the kids. Now, Claire was given a private education, and she was quite popular. She was a cute kid with unruly blonde hair. She was very fit because she was athletic. And looking at her pictures, I mean, she just had a gorgeous smile.
That she did. Now, Claire wasn't the best student in the world, but she was athletic, and she became an expert skier. She was close with her mom, and they did gardening together. When Claire was 15, her adopted father, Charlie, died. Well, that's kind of traumatic in this household.
Oh, very much so.
So Claire decided to become a nurse like Betty had been, which she did.
Right. She was 29, and she was attending a friend's party when a young man, Malcolm Webster, caught her eye. He would become her one and only true love in life, according to her brother. Betty disliked Malcolm, Claire's mom, Betty, from their first meeting. He actually called her stupid the first time they met.
Yeah,
so,
well, that's kind of a deal breaker, isn't it?
Isn't that awful?
You know, first time you meet the woman who's going to become your mother-in-law, you call her stupid?
But he could be kind of gruff and insulting, and I think that's something he picked up from his dad.
Sure.
Right? I don't think that he saw how hurtful it was, not making excuses for him, but I'm just thinking this is kind of the normal way you talked in Malcolm's world.
Yeah, that's right.
So people just kind of saw him as odd because he was otherwise this very gentlemanly, polite Englishman. Now, Betty, of course, she loves her daughter and didn't want to spoil her happiness because she seemed very much in love with Malcolm. So she tried to get over that first meeting and had some better times with him, but was never really crazy about him. He never really won her over.
Right. So at the time of the marriage, Malcolm was unemployed, as he often was, being between jobs. He moved from job to job fairly frequently.
So a mother's not going to like that.
Nope.
No.
But he did eventually find a job in northern Scotland, so he and Claire moved there to start a life together. They both worked, and Claire took classes in healthcare science at the University of Aberdeen. So in September of 1993, they got married. It was a nice traditional wedding. Claire's brother stood in for her father and gave her away. Claire and Malcolm seemed like a happy, attractive couple with a bright future. But in just 8 months, Claire would die in a fiery explosion.
Yeah, it's just awful. The couple, they moved into a home together and began planning a life together like you do. Claire was really looking forward to starting a family when she finished her college degree, so she's trying to do things right. But family, friends, and co-workers were beginning to notice some changes in her that they really didn't find encouraging. She had become submissive to her new husband. He used to correct her grammar and tell her to stand up straight and take your hands out of your pockets. Don't slouch. He just kind of talked to her the way his father had talked to him as a child.
Yeah, he's just repeating what he was brought up on.
Yeah, but it's so rude and inappropriate. But Claire accepted it and was pretty submissive, and this was not going over well with people who really cared about her.
No. But that's going to be a common thing with his intended victims.
Sure.
Friends notice personality changes in them.
Absolutely, you're right. Claire did remain outwardly happy, but her energy had fallen off. And let's remember, she's only married a few months. This isn't like years of marriage, so of course she's still pretty happy. She complained of feeling tired and strung out. She blamed the move and the change in climate for making her feel kind of blah. But friends who called her often found her asleep at all times of the day. When they called the house for her, Malcolm would answer and tell them that she was asleep and he didn't want to bother her so he wouldn't wake her. Claire had mentioned to a girlfriend that Malcolm was very considerate and generous. He had purchased life insurance, so if anything happened to either of them, it would be for certain that the other would be provided for. She found this very touching.
Some people might find it creepy.
Yes, but Claire didn't, because Claire is an innocent person.
And she's thinking, how nice.
Yes.
He's providing for the family.
She's a young newlywed in love.
So on May 27th, 1994, Malcolm's working on a report for the hospital, and this report had to be on his manager's desk by 9 o'clock the next morning. So at 11:30 in the night, Malcolm decides to drive to the hospital to deliver the report. And according to his statements to police, Claire said she would go along for the ride.
Yeah, so...
You think? I mean, she was drugged pretty good.
Well, we'll get into that.
Okay.
We're just saying what Malcolm's story was.
I'll backtrack on that.
No, that's okay. It's just that this is Malcolm's story. We're not saying that this is the facts, right?
That's right.
Right. So Claire had been known to doze off on car trips, according to Malcolm, so he packed her a blanket, and they left their home just before midnight. On the way, Malcolm said he forgot something and turned back towards their house. But instead of taking the regular route back, he took this back rural road. In the dark, he said he was blinded by a motorcycle headlight that was coming toward him on the wrong side of the road. He swerved to avoid the motorcycle, and he lost control of their car. The Jeep he was driving went off the road and hit a tree. Malcolm told police he had to use his leg to push his door open. The trees were preventing him from getting to Claire on her side of the car, so he decided he was going to pull her out from his side of the car. He said he remembered smelling smoke and gas, and the next thing he knew, he was crawling through the brush up to the road. Now, this story was going to change quite a bit depending on when and who he was talking to.
It does.
Yeah.
That's right.
Because
it wasn't that deserted a road, was it?
Turned out not to be.
Oh, he had lots of company on there.
Right, right.
So the first one to come by is a bus driver named Kevin Shearer. He was driving down the road on his way to pick up a group of lawyers and their partners who had been partying at a hotel called the Hatto House Hotel. And he came upon the accident. He could see the headlights of the crashed Jeep shining in the woods, and he saw Malcolm crawling up the slope. But he was doing nothing to get attention. He was just working his way up the slope.
Yeah, that's strange.
So Kevin approached Malcolm and asked him if he was okay and if there was anyone else in the car. Malcolm said he was okay and that, no, there was no one else in the car.
And according to Kevin, he clearly said that to him.
Right. So he's also scanning the area looking for the biker that Malcolm had mentioned, because maybe he went off the road too.
Well, yeah, I mean, if he was on a bike, he could be laying in the dirt at the side of the road.
Right. Now, he didn't see anyone on the ground or anyone in the car, so he ran to a nearby farm to call for help. And while he was gone, a fire started in the engine and took hold.
Yeah, so it was a few minutes later when Elizabeth Smith was driving past the scene. She was on her way to pick up her boyfriend, who was having a night out with the boys.
Everyone's out partying.
Yeah, well, this is Scotland, baby. So she didn't see Malcolm and did not stop. 10 minutes later, driving back with her boyfriend, they did stop, and she went and looked at the Jeep. She saw Claire lying unconscious in the reclined passenger seat as the fire in the engine was growing in size and intensity. Now, she thought that the impact must have knocked out this passenger, so she ran toward the Jeep to save her, but she was too late. Before she could get to Claire, the Jeep had burst fully into flames. So this image of Claire's body engulfed in flames. Can you imagine? It just tortures Elizabeth to this day to think about this memory.
Oh, I can only imagine.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
Now, by the time the Jeep burst into flames, Malcolm had already told three people that there was no one else in the Jeep with him. Eyewitnesses remembered seeing melted gas cans behind the passenger seat. After the crash, Malcolm was taken to the hospital, and he was put on oxygen. Now, his blood pressure and pulse, vital signs were all normal, and his only really injuries were things that he complained of, nothing visible. He complained of neck and leg pain, and somehow he managed to get himself kept in the hospital for 7 days, and that's with no fractures or visible injuries at all.
Right.
So he was a convincing guy, I guess?
He must have been.
Yeah.
And then he also, when the crash was being investigated, he was complaining or stating that he must have had a concussion or something as the reason for telling bystanders that he was alone in the car.
Exactly. That was his excuse.
He was confused.
Yeah. That was how it was working for him. Yeah. So, of course, poor Claire has died this horrible death, and there's a funeral. For Claire's headstone, Malcolm chooses a passage from The Merchant of Venice. "For she is wise, if I can judge of her, and fair she is, that mine eyes be true. And true she is, as she hath proved herself, and therefore, like herself wise, fair, and true, shall she be placed in my constant soul." So that's beautiful.
That is. Too bad he didn't mean any of it.
Well, and later on he would use this same passage with other women in other circumstances.
Yes.
But he always scored great with it. It's touching.
Well, I think there's nothing like quoting some Shakespeare to get the attention of women, right?
Oh, yeah. I'm feeling a little choked up now.
Yeah.
If I was to get flowers and someone saying that to me.
Okay.
Anyway.
Hints received.
Anyway, it goes to show that he was good at what he was doing. He was convincing.
He was.
And he was pretty good looking. Good looking guy, at least early on.
Yeah, early on he was.
Yeah.
And I think the interesting thing is that he finds something that works and he uses it again.
Yeah, in most aspects of life, right? That's a smart thing to do.
So, drugging his wives, that worked.
Yes.
Fire, it worked once.
Yeah.
He tried it again.
Sure.
And as you said, the quote from The Merchant of Venice, he found many uses for that.
I could see that this would be useful in many circumstances, and for the people at the graveside mourning, they were touched, like, oh my God, her poor husband.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Malcolm told police that he had fractured ribs and a neck injury. His parents were constantly at his bedside.
Police spoke to doctors, which I'm not sure if they did. They would learn that he didn't have any fractures or injuries.
Right.
Right.
But they didn't.
I guess not.
So back in Kent, in England, Claire's mother, Betty, was absolutely devastated to hear of her daughter's death.
Of course.
She told police that Claire had called her the day before and had told her of a close call she and Malcolm had had a month earlier on a remote road. Malcolm had taken her out on a long drive in the country. They had gone off the road, but a small bush had saved them from going over a ravine, and a farmer had come along and pulled a jeep out with a tractor.
So that's setting off alarm bells in Betty's head.
Isn't
a little
it?
Bit.
It sounds like a rehearsal.
Kind of, yeah.
Right?
Or a failed attempt.
Right.
Yep. For weeks leading up to the accident, Claire had been complaining to friends of feeling unwell. The day before her death, she'd gone to a fitness class with her friend Leslie Roberts. As they were chatting afterwards, Claire said that there was definitely something wrong with her and she planned to see a doctor. Now, Leslie was a nurse and she had worked alongside Claire and Malcolm at the hospital. She was asked to pick up some clothes for Malcolm at their house while he was hospitalized. While she was there at the house, she saw three bottles of hospital medication on their coffee table. So she saw the epilepsy drug Epilim?
Yeah, that must be a European anticonvulsant. It's not one used over here.
Okay. Also a bottle of carbamazepine?
Yeah, and that's a epileptic drug.
Okay. And another unlabeled drug. So these were all epilepsy drugs. And
well, we don't know the unlabeled one. The other two
true.
Are... The other two are anti-epileptics.
She may have recognized it as that. I'm not sure. But, yeah, we don't know for sure because it wasn't labeled. Although sometimes you can look at pills and you know what they are, especially if you're someone who's used to giving them.
Possibly.
Yeah. But anyway, there are three drugs there with no reason for them being there is the point.
Yeah, I mean, neither of them had epilepsy, even though Malcolm claimed to have epilepsy as a young kid.
Yeah.
But he didn't have it as an adult.
No, and these weren't prescribed to him.
No, they weren't.
So it's just mind-boggling to me that this was another thing that was just swept under the carpet, apparently. Of course, Leslie was alarmed by it. It was a big deal to her because she knew enough about them and about medications and things to know that this was odd. Plus, she knew that Claire had been sleepy and acting strangely.
Yeah, so, and she's a medical person, so she's starting to get some bad vibes here.
Exactly. Malcolm wept openly and he was actually shaking during Claire's funeral. So although Betty was very angry with him, he was the driver after all, she tried to comfort him in his grief. So how heartbreaking that she is actually heartbroken, but she's making an effort to make this guy feel better, who really couldn't care less.
Not in the least.
So that's really heartbreaking. Also her brother Peter, he felt bad for Malcolm. So they were reaching out to Malcolm.
Yep,
after he had killed their loved one. It seemed to be a tragic accident, but there were obviously some people who were questioning this. Leslie believed that Malcolm had been cheating on Claire, and she was convinced that this wasn't an accident at all. And let's just say that Malcolm is known to have pretty much always had several women in the wings.
He was definitely a ladies' man.
He was never monogamous.
No.
So Leslie did go to the police with her concerns, but she would say that she was pretty much dismissed. And this again could be related somewhat to Malcolm's father being high up in the police.
It could have been. But the police department over the years continued to downplay any evidence of foul play because the question kept getting raised.
Sure.
That this was not an accident.
Right.
But nothing ever came of it until somewhere down the road, which we'll discuss.
Of course.
So the forensic examiner determined that the fire had started as a result of the engine's impact with the tree, and her husband couldn't communicate effectively with witnesses because he was concussed and dazed.
Yeah, so that's what you mentioned a little while
ago. That's what we said.
That was his excuse, and I'm just surprised that the police went along with it. Although I guess if you asked a doctor, is that possible, you'd have to say, well, sure, it's possible.
Sure, it's possible.
Right.
But, you know, Malcolm's story was incomplete and confusing. To some, he said that he had heard Claire scream. Others, no.
No.
Right?
Right.
Nobody else in that car.
Right.
They also wondered what he was doing on that rural road, because it wasn't the road one would normally drive between the hospital and their home. It was common for them to call for Claire as early as 8 p.m. and be told by Malcolm that she was in bed for the night. She was always tired.
Yeah, you know, a lot of her friends found this odd. This is a young, healthy woman. Why is she always tired?
Yeah. Now, if she were a 70-year-old guy, that'd be understandable.
A little bit more, sure. Now, in the months of his marriage to Claire, Malcolm had actually taken out a dozen life insurance policies on her.
That's an awful lot. And remember, they weren't married very long, right?
No, 8 months.
8 months.
Yeah.
And he's got a dozen life insurance policies.
He does. And he submitted a claim less than 2 weeks after her death.
Well, sure, you want that money.
Well, he did have bills to pay, I guess, if you want to be devil's advocate there. It turned out to be a total of £208,000 that was paid to him in June 1994. He also received a widower's pension. And by that November, he had collected on all these policies, and he had spent nearly everything.
That's amazing.
So in a few months.
So 5 months.
Yeah.
He's gone through £250,000.
Right.
Holy cow.
I know.
So just a few weeks after Claire's death, Malcolm made the moves on a new woman. He picked her up in his new Land Rover. Now, there's been some comment on that, too. Wouldn't you think you're driving a SUV, Jeep type of thing that's caused the death of your wife? You'd be a little leery about getting in the same kind of car.
Well, maybe, but Land Rovers are super nice, and he had lots of money.
Well, he had all that money.
Yeah.
And he took this lady out for a nice expensive meal. So he seemed very happy to talk to her about his wife's accident, and he even took her to visit Claire's grave.
Yeah, well, Malcolm, it turns out, liked to take his dates to Claire's gravesite. This was one of his favorite stops to make. He befriended Brenda Grant from the United States by email, and she traveled to Scotland to meet him. She came over in August of 1995, and they were in an intimate relationship by that September. He got very emotional telling her about Claire's death. He claimed to have burned his feet and that he would just hear her screaming in his sleep. He had a lot of drama to share about it, which kind of got to her, I guess. She felt bad for him.
Yeah, but he didn't feel the same about her because they broke up.
Well, did he feel much about anyone? Let's just...
No, he didn't.
No.
So he got a job with an IT company selling medical software to hospitals in Saudi Arabia. Now, Malcolm said the memories in the United Kingdom were too much for him, and he needed to get away. And it was in Saudi Arabia that he met his second wife at a dinner party. So this lady's name is Felicity Drum, who is a very impressive person. She worked hard and accumulated a healthy sum of money. She was at a friend's dinner party when this charming Englishman sat beside her and charmed her. He told funny stories, called his parents Mummy and Daddy. Now, Felicity was a nurse who hadn't spent much time on relationships because she was busy working hard and saving money. She, in fact, had traveled from New Zealand to the Saudi country to make money. She was busy working hard, saving money. She'd paid off her mortgage back in New Zealand and had a significant tax-free nest egg. Her father, Brian, was a high school principal who had instilled in her and her sisters a strong work ethic. She worked 10-hour shifts as an oncology nurse in Saudi Arabia, which is stressful work, definitely, as an oncology nurse. But she had over 98,000 New Zealand pounds in the bank. in addition to paying off all her debts. So she was doing quite well.
Well, and, yeah, a lot better than most people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At a fairly young age.
Yeah, very young age.
So right from the beginning, she's attracted to Malcolm Webster, although she said he pushed things along a little too quickly for her.
Well, he had a schedule to keep here, you know?
Well, yeah.
He's running out of money.
He ran out of his first dead wife's money. He needs to do something.
Absolutely. And he did work, though.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah. His English computer geek image was attractive to many women, and I think he gained their trust quite easily.
He did.
Felicity opened up to him about her reason for working there and how she'd paid off her mortgage and had money in the bank.
Oh, yeah. Nothing sweeter to hear for Malcolm.
I know. This was right? Music to his ears. So just 8 months after they met, he proposed to her. The months of their courtship, he filled with chocolates and flowers and gentlemanly gestures. Felicity accepted his proposal without hesitation. The couple went to Felicity's hometown in New Zealand, and they were married there in the Catholic Church. Now, unlike Claire's mom, Betty, Malcolm was really impressive to Felicity's parents. And they threw a big party after the wedding. They were really happy that he was part of their family.
Yeah, see, he learned to work the in-laws.
That's a good point. Yeah, I never really thought of that, but I think you're right. He was getting better at it.
Yes, he was. He's honing his skills.
Absolutely. For their honeymoon, they visited Cook's Beach on the Coromandel Peninsula. But shortly after they arrived, Felicity drank a cup of tea and slept for 36 hours.
That's an amazing amount of sleep. Wouldn't you think something had been slipped into your tea?
Well, I don't
36
know.
36 hours of sleep?
Sure. I don't know if it would be my first thought, but it is very strange. When she finally woke up, she was quite shocked. She'd never slept anywhere close to that in her life. She questioned Malcolm for allowing her to sleep for so long. But then he told her that she had woken several times and gone back to bed. He said that he'd even fed her a meal, but she had no memory of it. So, I think she's still groggy when she wakes up, and that's part of how this works. Because he keeps them in almost a continual fog.
It does.
Yeah.
Plus the medications, I don't know how much we'll talk about it, but you can get some amnesia from them also.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think so. So even if you're not constantly drugged, your mind is maybe never really back to full normal.
Kind of wrapped your brain in cotton or something.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, exactly.
So her fatigue continued after they returned from the honeymoon. So this is a fairly new onset stuff.
Yes.
And continuing. So we can't just blame stress of the honeymoon or whatever.
Well, I think she kind of did.
So she visited a neurologist and complained of blackouts, headaches, double vision, and fatigue. She also said that everything she ate tasted bitter. The neurologist diagnosed her with vertebral headaches, which is a migraine type of variant.
Mm-hmm.
And blood work was done.
So what do you think about his diagnoses? Do you think that he was doing everything he should have been?
Sure. At that point.
You don't think he should have done toxicology blood work?
No. It's not at the top of your differential diagnosis.
Okay.
Down there a ways. So eventually, I mean, if let's suppose she continued seeing him with the complaints not resolving, you're going to start looking for other things that would cause those symptoms.
Well, I wonder if he did an MRI, or is that more of a newer thing? Did they do that as much in the 90s?
I don't know, but it wouldn't have shown anything.
But he could have been looking for some things in that way. Malcolm and Felicity had decided to move to Scotland. But before they left, her doctor did tell her that some of her liver tests were abnormal. But then with planning the move and everything going on, and I'm sure by Malcolm not encouraging her to follow up with it, she let it slide and it was kind of at the bottom of her priorities at that time. So just months after they moved to Scotland, Felicity found out that she was pregnant. She was very happy and expected her husband to share in this joy, but he became angry at first. He told her several reasons why it was a bad time for them to start a family. But then, with some time passing, he did accept it, and he was helping and planning for the birth, and he even seemed a little bit excited about it. He really wanted a son. It was important to him to have a male child, which must be related to his weird dad, I guess.
Yes. So throughout her marriage to Malcolm, Felicity slurred her words, would lose her balance, and slept for extended periods of time. Now, she chalked this up at this point to the pregnancy.
Sure, that makes sense to me.
Yep. And at 16 weeks gestation, she visited her doctor, who said her symptoms were stress-related.
Okay, well, losing balance, sleeping a lot, sure. But what about slurring your words?
Yeah, I don't know about that being stress-related.
No, that's pretty alarming.
Yeah. So they lived in a cottage in rural Aberdeenshire in Scotland. In September of 1997, Felicity lost everything she owned because the cottage had caught on fire. She arrived home to find Malcolm, who said he had arrived there in the nick of time. He had managed to save some of their possessions. For the rest, he assured her they were well insured. Now, her purse and the contents of her wallet were gone.
But months later, Felicity did see her driver's license. It was propped up on Malcolm's desk in their study. Now, we're going to find out he was using that to practice forging her signature.
Yes, he had nefarious motive.
But she decided, oh, well, he must have forgotten to tell me that he'd found that in the fire.
Yeah, I mean, my impression from reading the book and seeing the documentary, this woman is way too trusting.
Well, okay.
She's got all these things going on with her physically.
Yeah.
I think she's catching him in lies that she writes off.
I think you're right. I think a lot of us do that. And she doesn't want to see this, so any excuse she can think of to let it go, she's going to go with.
Yeah, you're right.
I can kind of see that. And I think when you're in love, you do stuff like that sometimes, especially when you're young and a bit on the naive side. Plus, you know, he seemed very convincing. He was good at this. We can't forget that.
He was honing his craft. He was very good.
So we're not going to blame the victims here.
I wasn't.
He was diabolical, and he was getting better at it, like you said, honing his craft. Now, they did have a son in 1998, which is a relief to me because I wonder if they'd had a daughter, if he would have done something to the daughter for life insurance money.
Possibly, right?
He did seem like the kind of guy who thought having a son was more important. So their son Edward was born in 1998, and they moved back to New Zealand, so Felicity would have the support of her family as she's raising her child. While they were preparing for the move, they put their belongings in a large storage facility. So this was owned by a large, well-known moving company in the area. This massive facility housed the belongings of hundreds of families.
Big place.
Yes. In November of 1998, the facility had a major fire. 80 firefighters worked at this scene, and the fire raged for several days. The final costs for damages of this fire would be over £5 million. Now, there was a detailed investigation. It was determined that workmen had left a glass blowtorch, which ignited on the roof. But Malcolm had been to this site just moments before the fire started. He had gone to pick up a box of paperwork from the storage unit. He had told Felicity he was stopping at a store near the facility and he would stop by to pick up some papers there. He had the genealogy of his family in a suitcase there, and he wanted to share it with a friend, he said. When he returned home, the news of the fire was on the evening news, but Malcolm was quite calm. He told his wife, "Don't worry, honey, we're fully insured."
Yeah, don't worry.
Now, he opened the suitcase, happy that he'd saved his genealogy, but he'd picked up the wrong suitcase, and this one was actually filled with some of Felicity's clothing. So, if we're going to think that maybe Malcolm set this fire...
We are.
It makes perfect sense that he would try and save his family genealogy before he started the fire.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, he just screwed up and took the wrong suitcase.
Exactly. So, 1 week after the fire, Malcolm submitted his insurance claim, and that was for over £68,000.
Right. And the moving company disputed that, but they eventually settled.
Right. After the claim was settled, that's when they moved back to New Zealand.
Right. And no one was ever arrested for the fire.
No, because the workmen adamantly denied that they left a blowtorch on the roof.
Yeah.
So it seems pretty certain that this was Malcolm's work. We have to remember the college was burned down. His first wife died in a fire. This guy likes to set fires.
His house was burned.
Yes.
The storage facility was burned.
There's more fires coming up.
There's a recurring theme here.
Absolutely.
So while they're looking for a home in New Zealand, they're living with Felicity's parents, Brian and Margaret. So at least at this point, they still like Malcolm.
Yeah, they do.
So Malcolm and Felicity were supposed to pool their resources to buy a house near her family. He was to sell his cottage and contribute the proceeds for their new house. Now, Felicity had allowed him access to her account, so all of their money would be in a joint account. She had also sold her home, which she owned outright, to add to their house fund. So they're supposed to have a pretty good nest egg to use for a down payment on a new home.
Yeah, I don't know if it's true, but in the miniseries that we watched from the BBC, she had about $300,000, and he was supposed to put another $300,000
in. They were going to have $600,000.
So this was going to be quite a home.
It was.
Yeah.
One small problem, though. Malcolm said he's having problems getting his Scottish bank to transfer his funds. So he continued dragging this on until early 1999, and the couple was at one point close to losing their deposit on their dream house. Now, in February of 1999, the house they were planning to buy was set on fire by an arsonist. Someone had put papers through the letterbox and set them on fire with an accelerant. Well.
So another fire.
Another fire.
A few days later, there was a fire at her parents' home in the middle of the night. Malcolm, who'd been in the bathroom a short while before that, was woken. He said, when Felicity heard a loud crack and smelled some burning. Now, he told her, don't worry about it, go back to sleep. But when she refused to do that, he got out of bed and looked around. Eventually, he called out, there's a fire, and a chair in the living room was up in flames. Felicity ran out of the house with their infant son, as her dad, Brian, ran to the chair with buckets of water to put out the fire. Now, what really annoyed Brian at the time is that Malcolm went and filled the tea kettle
right. And
brought that over, like that was any help.
Like you're going to piss on the fire or something, you know?
Yeah, right.
Not much to do.
Yeah. Now, the property wasn't destroyed, but they did have to move out and stay with Felicity's sister, Jane. So, the way Brian's thinking about Malcolm at this point is like, he's kind of an odd duck, not maybe with the best common sense. But he's not actually disliking him.
Not yet.
No, but he does start to have suspicions as time goes on about what Malcolm's up to. And especially this putting off getting his money transferred.
Yeah.
Getting your money transferred. It's really as simple as a phone call, maybe a couple faxes.
It's very simple.
Yes.
So his story is not holding up well.
Yeah, and Brian knows enough to know that.
Yeah.
These aren't stupid people. Felicity and her parents are quite bright.
No, that's true.
And her sister, too, a bright woman, Jane, who they were staying with.
Right. So Felicity's pretty shocked by all this bad luck they're having. And they could have died in the fire. And that might have been the intent.
I think so. I mean, I think he's got all this pressure at this point to close on that house and get his money over.
Yeah.
So I think he's getting desperate.
So he's got to do something.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, when Felicity woke up at the sound of the crack of the fire, he tried to tell her to go back to sleep. It was nothing.
He was always telling her to go back to sleep, right? He liked his women to sleep a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and Felicity was still pretty tired and sleeping long periods of time.
So it's really quite remarkable that she didn't sleep through it.
It is.
Yeah. So the deadline for signing on the new house is approaching. And Felicity says, we're going to the bank. I want to make sure this is all taken care of. So they're driving to the bank. Malcolm starts complaining. And this, I know it's not funny, but this just cracks me up.
It was almost comical.
So he starts complaining that the steering wheel isn't working. And he's weaving all over the highway. And strangely enough, the car's picking up speed at the same time. And he yells at Felicity that the car's out of control. As they're headed straight for a street lamp, Felicity grabbed the wheel. And the steering worked just fine. It responded normally, and they avoided hitting the pole. Now, the car ended up in a ditch anyway, and there was very little damage to the car. But Malcolm was telling Felicity, you need to stay in the car, stay in the car. And then he went around to the trunk and opened it. So he was going over there to set a fire, right, to this car?
He was.
Felicity still wanted to get back to the bank, though. So when she got out of the car and approached him, you know, in another act of desperation, I guess, he clutched his left side and said he was having severe chest pain. So here he's feigning a heart attack.
Got a heart attack. So they had to go to the hospital.
So Felicity wanted to go to the bank still, but he begged her to come to the hospital with him. And she felt like, well, what kind of wife am I? if I go to the bank and my husband's dying of a heart attack. So she gave in, and she went to the hospital with him, and they missed their appointment with the bank.
They did.
So he bought himself some more time with this.
Yeah, but we're going to come to the conclusion pretty soon.
Yeah, he's going to get found out here.
Yep. So a week later, February 18th, Malcolm's happy to announce that his money had finally come in. Let's go. So he tells Felicity to get Edward dressed because he was taking them on a picnic to celebrate. So they drove happily with their picnic stuff, and Malcolm handed Felicity a water bottle to keep her fluids up.
Yes, and we know that there were drugs in there.
There were, because it's the last thing Felicity remembered of that day, until her cell phone kept ringing and ringing, and she finally woke. It's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. She slumped over in the passenger seat, unaware of how she had gotten there.
She found herself in a remote forest.
Yeah, she's looking around.
And everything's like a blur to her. Malcolm was about 300 yards away, pushing Edward in his stroller. And when she finally answered her cell phone, it was her father, who sounded very anxious. And he told her she needed to come home right away. He actually said to her, "It doesn't matter what Malcolm says. You just stop whatever you're doing and you get home. This is serious." So he'd been doing some research.
He found out Malcolm.
Yeah. So Felicity got out of the car and yelled for Malcolm to come back. And she said he just went absolutely ballistic at this point. He just lost it, yelling at her, "What are you doing awake? You need to get back to sleep. I was just taking Edward for a walk." So he didn't want to go back to the house, of course. But Felicity said, "Something bad has happened at home. I can tell by my father's voice. We need to go to my sister's house." So Malcolm didn't want to go. He was upset and angry, but he did relent. I guess his plan is not really salvageable at this point.
Nope, he's pulling out. Because when they pulled into the driveway of her sister's house, Malcolm told Felicity that her father was going to talk to her about some nonsense about her money. So Malcolm left Felicity and Edward in the car and walked away.
He just left.
And just kept walking.
Yeah.
So her parents told Felicity that all of her money was gone, and Malcolm had taken out several life insurance policies on her life. So there's no question that Brian's phone call has saved his daughter's life.
I know, and it's just amazing that she did wake up.
Yeah. So they were horrified to find the trunk of the car filled with gas cans, newspapers, and wood. She realized that he was pushing the baby away for safety before he burned her alive.
That was his plan.
That's his plan.
So it's all coming together for her now in this moment. Everything she'd brushed under the rug or he'd made excuses for. Quickly, she's realizing that he'd been drugging her at least since the honeymoon, because that's when she'd slept 36 hours
straight.
That's
that 36-hour marathon sleep, right?
Yeah, probably even before that.
Probably.
So another interesting thing was that little Edward had suffered from eczema, which had cleared up completely after Malcolm was gone.
So do you think he was poisoning his son too?
Doing something to him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he was drugging Felicity during her pregnancy and while she was breastfeeding.
Yeah.
Hair samples from Felicity were sent for testing, and they confirmed that she had been drugged for a very long period of time, even during the pregnancy. Brian, her dad, had been suspicious of his son-in-law, and he'd gone ahead and done some investigating. On Malcolm's laptop, he found emails to real estate agents in Devon and Cornwall saying that he was moving back with his son and he was interested in some properties. He'd purchased return flights for himself and Edward, but Felicity only had a one-way flight there because he expected her to be dead before they returned to Scotland. There were life insurance policies with her name forged. And this turned out to be for what would be the equivalent pretty much to about $1.5 million here in the U.S. He'd sent emails to friends back home, and he'd told them that Felicity was suffering from postpartum depression and had to be supervised for her own safety. So he's really laying down some groundwork here.
He's being very thorough.
Isn't he? But you can see right through it once you look into it.
Once you know the backstory, right?
Yeah, once you put all this together.
So now they've got fires and illnesses explained.
Yeah.
And Felicity was sure that Malcolm had murdered his first wife, Claire, and she would have been next. And she had lost her savings. Over $200,000 had been taken from her account and transferred to an account in Malcolm's name only, back in Scotland.
Yeah, so this is awful. I mean, it's just money, but she'd spent years working for this, and it's just taken from her. And this is the father of her child, who she realizes was going to burn her to death.
He was.
It's just outrageous and terrifying. Now, Malcolm had checked into a local hotel, and Felicity went to meet him in the parking lot with her uncle to ask him some questions, maybe in hopes that she could get some of the money back.
But that's kind of dangerous, don't you think?
Well, her uncle went with her, and she was out in a public place.
Yeah. All right.
Maybe a little bit, but I could see how you'd want some kind of, I hate this word, but closure.
Yeah.
You'd want to, you know, at least be able to confront him, because he'd just run off.
Yeah.
So she told Malcolm that she knew he had planned to kill her, and his response was bone-chilling.
Yes, isn't it?
He actually said to her, I gave you a son and a good life. You would have died happy, and walked away. So this coldness was just shocking. Felicity went to the police and told them the whole story, but it was too late to arrest Malcolm. He'd returned immediately to the UK, and police would find out that his father paid his way home. And what they did is they ended up banning him from re-entering New Zealand.
Yeah, they flagged his passport. So, somewhat unbelievably, Malcolm was fighting through the courts to get custody of his son. He was attacking Felicity as an unfit mother, and his dad was footing the bill for the lawyers.
To me, that takes a lot of nerve. I mean, he should have been thankful he wasn't in prison at that point. But one really creepy aside is that Felicity's sister Jane found in a camcorder she'd bought from Felicity this footage. So this was footage of some happy drum family events, and Malcolm had set it to a soundtrack of this morose funeral music. So how creepy is that? That just shows you a whole other side to this guy.
Doesn't it?
Yeah. It took over 3 months for investigators to work through all the information that Felicity shared with them. The drum family gave them piles of bank statements and life insurance documents. And her dad had found more full gas cans in their house. Felicity had no first-hand knowledge of what Malcolm had done to his first wife, Claire. She only knew what Malcolm had told her, and a lot of that was untrue. A New Zealand officer spoke with Malcolm early on, but didn't get very far with him. He had an explanation for each individual event, but it was the whole range of inconsistencies and coincidences that made his story so unbelievable. They were able to gather significant evidence that Malcolm had robbed Felicity of her savings and drugged her over and over for years. It was also quite clear that he had tried to burn down the house Felicity planned to buy for them and her parents' house. Felicity's sisters told police that he was drugging and stealing from her, and he was telling them that he was concerned for her mental health. He said she was severely depressed, as if he was laying the groundwork for a staged suicide.
Oh, I think he was.
Yeah, it seemed like he was laying the groundwork for a few different ways that he might have gone with this. When Felicity's doctor learned all about this, his outlook on her medical condition then changed, and it was quite clear that everything could be explained by the drugs. Malcolm could put Felicity to sleep whenever it was convenient for him, which was probably quite often. Arrest warrants were issued in 2000 for arson, attempted murder, and drugging his wife. He sent letters in 2003 accusing Felicity of making these wild and untrue allegations against him.
Now, one of Felicity's sisters, Jane, had a chance meeting with a senior British police officer in 2006 and mentioned that she really wanted to find out where Malcolm was and confront him. The officer talked her out of that but made calls to get her in touch with Scottish authorities. So Jane was interviewed by Scottish detectives and helped them start a new inquiry that would involve agencies from around the world and end up costing millions of dollars. So she finally got the ear of the Scottish people.
She did, and it turned out being a huge international investigation.
Well, sure. We've got the British Isles. We have Australia, New Zealand, probably even Saudi Arabia, Abu Dhabi.
Yeah, I don't think that ever went anywhere, but yeah.
Now, they searched the electoral roll in United Kingdom, and they found an address for Malcolm John Webster. He was living in the town of Oban on the coast of Scotland, living with a woman named Simone Banerjee. Simone was independently wealthy and engaged to Malcolm, even though he had never been awarded a divorce from Felicity. So Felicity had refused to divorce him in order to prevent him from marrying anybody else, another victim.
Sure.
So that's pretty clever.
It is, yeah, definitely. And it's kind of a sacrifice for her to make.
I would think.
Now, Simone was a beautiful nursing manager who Malcolm met at work, and over time, he'd really pulled her into his complicated web. Simone met Malcolm in August 2004 at the Lornan Islands District General Hospital. He was working as a nurse, specialized in the safe handling of patients, so kind of like occupational health,
right.
Education. Simone, who was 41, was financially secure from a trust fund that had been set up by her parents. As an only child, Simone was a little bit introverted, and she'd always been an excellent student. She was loyal, and she managed to maintain a small group of friends from college who she spoke to quite often. Now, on their first meeting, Simone was sending a fax to her father with the details of a 270,000-pound house that she wanted to buy. Malcolm saw the paperwork over her shoulder and told her that he had once been a real estate agent. That was not true. Simone told Malcolm she was buying the house outright and mentioned her trust to him. This would have been appealing to him, of course. He was in a relationship with another woman, but he soon broke that one off and pursued Simone.
Sure, there's more to be had there.
Absolutely. But Simone wasn't easy to win over. She was smart and a little less trusting than the other two women had been.
Right.
Of course, she's older.
She is.
Yeah. So it took over a year and a fake bout of leukemia for him to win her over.
Yeah, he pulled out all the stops with Simone.
I think he had to.
So when Malcolm told Simone about Claire's death, he claimed to have been trapped in the car for some time himself, and when he finally crawled out, he could hear her screams. He said he was in intensive care for a week, and he also claimed that Claire was pregnant when she died. So just a whole bunch of mistruths here.
Really building it up.
And then the other big thing was that he never told Simone that he had been married to Felicity or that he had a child. So then he told Simone he was dying of cancer. This was just before Christmas in 2005. Simone felt like he was such an unlucky man and she felt sorry for him. So he often called her in the middle of the night and Simone would go to his house to comfort him. So she decided she couldn't leave him alone and moved him into her house.
You know, he'd also told her that his father had recently died. He had a lot of lies that he'd told her.
Yeah.
Conveniently, he didn't have his chemotherapy treatment at the local hospital. He traveled to Royal Marsden, and she would go and visit him there. He greeted her at the airport with his eyebrows and his head completely shaved, even his body hair. He even lost some weight, and he punctured his arms with needles to leave bruises and needle marks. So he went all out on this.
He sure did. Well, he's got to be convincing, right?
Yeah. Now, in February 2006, Simone changed her will to leave her estate to Malcolm. No evidence was found that he had bought life insurance on her, but he would inherit £300,000 if she died. When Simone dropped off Malcolm at the airport to go back for his chemo treatments, he was actually spending time with other women. He even flew to Paris once to see an old flame and spent a week-long holiday. So this was Brenda, and he told Brenda, too, that he had cancer.
And Brenda's the U.S. citizen.
Yes.
That he roped in.
That's right. Police would uncover three women that he was actually seeing at this time while he was in a relationship with Simone and getting chemotherapy, supposedly. Malcolm proposed to Simone in September 2006, and he gave her a 6,000-pound diamond and platinum ring, which he'd paid for with money he'd taken from Felicity Drum's life savings. As Simone planned their wedding, the authorities were actually closing in on Malcolm. It was Malcolm's plans to kill her on their honeymoon that brought police to her. The couple owned a 38-foot yacht, which was moored at Oban. They planned to spend their honeymoon participating in a transatlantic race from the Canaries to the Caribbean. Police became convinced that Simone was in serious danger from this man. The fear was that a 3 to 4 week trip out in the open ocean was the ideal situation for Malcolm to kill her.
Wouldn't it be?
It would be so easy.
That's almost an easy decision.
Yeah. I mean, that's a lot easier than a cruise ship.
For sure.
There's only the two of you and no cameras.
Right.
But then can I add what a horrible way to die that would be?
Yes, it would be.
Yeah.
So the police are convinced that Malcolm's going to throw her overboard, and they're looking for a way to warn Simone. They investigated, and they learned about a dustbin fire at the hospital a couple of years previously, 3 years previously. Malcolm had blamed a patient, and was made out to be a bit of a hero, as he was the one who had discovered the fire.
Yeah, and actually carried the man out as if he was quite a hero.
Yeah, but it turns out that the guy had pretty advanced Alzheimer's, wasn't capable of setting a fire, much less even holding a cigarette and lighting it.
Yeah, so the hospital had doubts about it right from the beginning.
Yeah, but once they got the details of this new fire that was possibly set by Malcolm, it was enough to allow the police to present Simone with an Osman letter.
Yeah, so let's explain what Osman letters are.
What's that?
Osman letters were typically given to gang members or career criminals to warn them when there was an imminent threat to their life, like if there's a hit out on their life. A few witnesses in high-profile cases had received them, but none of the officers on this particular case had ever used an Osman letter before. Simone would remember that it was just a normal work day for her, and she was brought into her manager's office, where two officers read this letter to her, and they gave her a copy to keep. The letter was signed by the assistant chief constable. Now, in the letter, it mentioned Felicity and the outstanding charges against Malcolm in New Zealand. It warned her that her life was in danger if she continued to be in a relationship with Malcolm Webster.
Her initial reaction was that she didn't believe any of it.
Right.
I mean, this can't be her Malcolm. So she put the letter in a desk drawer, and the following day, as police waited outside, she came home and met Malcolm in the kitchen. So she confronted Malcolm about Felicity and said she was returning his engagement ring. She realized then that she was in a dangerous situation in the kitchen with him. Malcolm, meanwhile, turned white or pale and said nothing.
Yeah, it seems like for that moment, he was like someone she didn't know and he was terrifying.
Yeah.
Like his face changed.
Well, she's probably thinking this might not have been such a good idea to confront him.
Absolutely. So now she's thinking, wow, this is really true and why did I do this? But he did quickly regain his composure. He packed a bag and left the house. And before he left, he actually printed up a document and handed it to her, where he gave up claims to her estate. Officers were guarding her house that night. Now, she's still having some trouble, though, believing that this man that she loved for years now is a complete fraud and dangerous. So she actually booked a hotel room for him, so she's still kind of helping him, so that he wouldn't be homeless. And against the advice of the police, she and a friend met him in a supermarket parking lot. She said a final goodbye to him, and he told her that he loved her. She actually filled his car with gas for him and gave him a hug goodbye.
Touching.
Well, I don't think she realized that he was going to actually kill her.
Yeah, not until
later.
She discovered that her life jacket had been tampered with, and it was useless because the foil on the cylinder was punctured. Now, Malcolm's life jacket was fine, so there's no doubt in Simone's mind that Malcolm was going to kill her by throwing her overboard.
Yeah, so this was new to me, the life jacket with the cylinders in it. And maybe I'm the only one, but I always thought a life jacket was just like a foamy, flotation-y thing.
Yeah, no, it's like the things you in the airplane. On a plane, they have things, they have cylinders because you pull those strings and it inflates.
Oh, I thought it was just air from, I don't know. Never mind.
But that's what they have.
I just never realized.
Her cylinder was useless, so her life jacket wouldn't have inflated.
Exactly.
And she wouldn't be able to stay afloat very long.
So that, I think, really was her holy shit moment.
Yeah, that was probably the grand finale.
She realized she was out on that boat with him and could have been quite easily killed. Now, Malcolm, of course, he knew at this point that the police were closing in on him. So he made some strange efforts. He tried to have himself sectioned under the Mental Health Act after he walked into an emergency room in Aberdeen on February 4th, 2008. He told the staff there that he was thinking of killing himself, so he was sent to the mental health nurse. But that nurse decided he wasn't genuinely suicidal and not psychotic, but that he was just trying to escape his problems by getting admitted to the hospital. So there's someone who could really figure things out. Didn't fall for it.
Right.
Don't hear that very often.
No.
No, usually people go along with things like that. But after being refused at the hospital, he went ahead and drove to the south coast of England, and he had his brother Ian call Simone to tell her that Malcolm had sent her an email where he said goodbye to her and told her he was taking his life. The email he wrote to Simone said that he loved her and had enjoyed his time with her. He He said he was sorry for the way things had turned out. So he didn't really say he was sorry for what he'd done. He said, I'm sorry for the way things have turned out. We've heard this kind of thing before.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not accepting any blame.
Right. Now she tried to contact him. So still, she's reaching out a hand to help him, which is shocking to me. But his phone was off. So the next day she learned that he was found alive in Cornwall. Carolyn and her husband found him in a parking lot sitting in his car, and they were able to persuade him to return home. So he maintained to his family that he had lost money in offshore investments, but that he was in no way a killer.
Not in the least, right.
Right.
Now, police, meanwhile, are working hard. They've searched Simone's house. They find a stolen laptop and an unlicensed gun. Then they announce that they are re-examining Claire's death, and the New Zealand police agree to look into the attempted murder of Felicity Drum, his second wife. Malcolm was charged at the Aberdeen Sheriff Department in 2009 for the murder of Claire, the attempted murder of Felicity, and attempting to bigamously marry Simone Banerjee in order to get access to her money.
Dr. James Grieve, a forensic pathologist for over 30 years, was able to prove that Claire was drugged by examining a small sample of tissue, which they called a sliver of her liver. This evidence was critical in the case against Malcolm Webster. Now, back when Claire died, the only routine test that they did was for alcohol. If she died just 2 or 3 years later, a routine drug test would have been done, and Malcolm would have been found out, so he had gotten lucky for a while. During the time after Claire's death, it was discovered Malcolm had started a relationship with a woman who actually worked at the pathology lab where these samples had been kept. Now, this woman would remember him asking her several times where Claire's specific tissue samples were kept. The trial of Malcolm Webster began in February 2011, and it lasted nearly 4 months. So this was the longest trial of a single accused person in Scottish legal history. Prosecutors claimed that Malcolm began drugging Claire soon after their wedding in 1993, and the drugs he gave her on the night of her murder had rendered her completely unconscious. He'd carried her to their Jeep and drove it down an embankment before setting it on fire with her inside. Then he pretended to 4 people that he was alone in the car when it crashed, which prevented her from being rescued, of course.
And then there's the fact of him taking out 12 insurance policies before he killed her, cashing in over £200,000 in payments, plus an additional £10,000 widower's pension. Then his attempted murder against Felicity was also brought up as part of his attempt to collect insurance payouts on her life, as were the multiple fires. Now, there were some serious issues over jurisdiction, but by running the case as one ongoing fraud because Malcolm had transferred Felicity's money from New Zealand to Scotland, then he could be tried in Scotland for that crime also.
Well, that's clever.
Wasn't it?
Yeah.
So officers from New Zealand traveled to the UK to assist and give evidence. Scottish defense attorney John McLeod flew to New Zealand and interviewed over 60 witnesses.
So this is just a huge expense.
Boy, I guess.
Yeah. In Scotland, the presumption of innocence means that people are rarely jailed ahead of their trial, even with these capital offenses. So Malcolm walked to and from the courthouse each day. So this is interesting to me. The next case we're doing, actually, is about people who may have been wrongly convicted. And these people spent years in prison or in jail waiting for their trial.
Right.
So this is interesting to me because part of me feels like if you are presuming someone's innocent, maybe they shouldn't be kept in jail. How is that fair? Unless there's the other side of it where you're protecting people and probably preventing them from fleeing. So it's definitely an interesting thing to talk about.
That's a topic that we'll cover sometime.
Well, we'll cover it in the next episode because it's a bigger issue there. But I just find it interesting that he was allowed to stay at home and walk to court each day. Now, it was 1 week before the end of the trial, though, when concerns of him taking off were significant, and Andy was remanded pending his verdict.
Yeah, so they get to a point where they're thinking that there's a flight risk.
Yeah, but it's only a week before the verdict.
I know.
So he was free for quite a long time.
Yeah, it was a 4-month trial, right?
That's
what you said. Now, the most compelling witnesses were the women who Malcolm had defrauded and planned to kill. Claire's elderly mother also testified about the crash Claire had mentioned to her that happened a month before the crash had killed her. A friend of Claire's testified that Malcolm had 4 cans of gas in the trunk of his car, and his Jeep smelled of gas 2 weeks before Claire died. It was so bad that she had insisted he open the windows.
Yeah, that's a horrible thing to do.
I guess it is.
I mean, I've driven my car with a can of gas in the back seat before, and the smell was awful.
Nauseating.
Yeah, it's not safe, of course, either. Malcolm did take the stand in his own defense at trial. But in a way, he seemed kind of reserved to his fate. He wasn't very animated. Maybe he was trying to play down the manipulative aspect of his personality that everyone else was testifying to. He denied murdering Claire, and he maintained his story about a motorcyclist coming at him on the wrong side of the road. He also denied attempting to murder Felicity. However, he did admit to deliberately going off the road to prevent her from getting to the bank when he was saying that the steering wasn't working.
Right.
And he admitted that he didn't want her to find out about his lies about the money. In hindsight, it was Malcolm's father who helped him get away with Claire's murder for so long. He'd encouraged the police to look at her death as an accident. Detectives were investigating whether Malcolm had been experimenting with dosages of drugs in the hospital shortly before Claire's death. When Alexander Webster found out, he went into a rage and hired a lawyer for his son. It's also suspected that Alexander knew about the deaths of the children under Malcolm's care in Abu Dhabi, and he used his influence to convince the authorities there to sweep it all under the rug. He also helped Malcolm to get out of New Zealand to avoid prosecution for his financial crimes and the drugging and the arson. So he was really instrumental in keeping Malcolm out of trouble, and he could have been responsible if Malcolm had ended up killing these other women.
He could have been, right?
Yes, absolutely.
So all the witnesses gave insight into Malcolm Webster's nature. Incredibly manipulative. This, along with the testimony of scientists and financial experts, would prove to the jury that he was guilty. So some of the verdicts were unanimous in the charges against him, and some were by majority. He was sentenced to life imprisonment on July 5, 2011, with a minimum sentence of 30 years. He was removed from the nursing register.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, isn't it? So Malcolm has reportedly told inmates that he expects to die in prison. And he's been described by one inmate as being really boring. So it was reported in 2011, so not too long after he was sentenced, that Webster had been attacked by another inmate with a metal pole.
Well, the worst thing to be in prison is a child killer, right?
Right.
And killing women isn't a lot better than that.
Not much higher on the ladder.
No. Many prisoners commit their crimes for passion while under the influence of drugs or alcohol, but the fact that Malcolm killed for money made him even more of a man for other prisoners to hate. So he was definitely a marked man in prison. Now, following repeated attacks where his nose had been broken and he had head injuries, he refused to shower for months on end because we all know the shower room in the prison is not a good place to be if you're a target.
No, right?
Right.
Now, he also converted to Islam. Although there's an ulterior motive here, too. But it gives him more prayer time each day, gives him better food, and he was hoping to get protection from Muslims in jail. But most of them just shunned him anyway.
Yeah. Oddly enough, or maybe we should have expected it, lots of women write to Malcolm in prison. And some of these women are women who knew him before this all happened. Now, the investigation into Malcolm Webster does continue because prosecutors believe there are more victims. There are some significant gaps in his timeline. Now, he went on walkabout in Australia for at least twice, and he's very secretive about what he was doing at that time. So it's possible he's killed others and hasn't been found out. Quite possible. And in December of 2013, the appeal court quashed his convictions on the 2 minor charges of fire-raising, but they did uphold the rest of his convictions. He appealed again, but dropped that appeal in March 2014. On September 9, 2014, Malcolm asked the Scottish Criminal Cases Review Commission to review his conviction and his sentence. His request was granted, and it took nearly 2 years for them to complete the review. In February 2016, the review was rejected. A spokesperson stated, "The commission's review has concluded, and this case has not been referred to the High Court." So that's it for him. He's going to be 82 when he's first eligible for parole.
If he gets to that point.
Exactly. But looking back, I really wonder why doctors didn't pick up on these symptoms of doping in the women, Claire and Felicity. But you're saying that checking for drugs wouldn't be your first thing to do.
No, it wouldn't be.
No.
I mean, it's only if you're seeing them repeatedly for the same symptoms that you start digging deeper.
Yeah, and I feel like Malcolm kept them from the doctor as much as he could. Because he was a nurse and they were nurses, and he said, you know, we know it's just a virus or it's just this or that. And
right.
He didn't really want them to go to the doctor. So he was super manipulative. But I also feel like, what about insurance companies? I feel like they really dropped the ball with his repeated claims from fires. I researched this and found that back in 1994, different insurance companies didn't share information about what they call serial claimants.
That's Malcolm.
Right. But I guess between the different companies, they didn't share it back then.
No.
Now they do, thankfully. But still, you know, between 94 and 99, he was paid claims on a wife who died in a fire, on a house fire, and then that huge fire at the storage facility. And these were all large claims. We're not talking about $1,000 or $2,000.
Exactly.
They were all over $50,000. So I really think that should have set off some red flags. What do you think?
I think so.
Yeah.
Although, again, you're saying that companies didn't talk to each other, share information.
That's true. So if these were different companies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if you were able to look at an overview and see what he'd been paid off for, you would be suspicious.
Well, yeah. And I think that's why it took years. I mean, as that one policeman had said, one individual thing he had perfectly reasonable sounding explanations for. It was the accumulation of coincidences and inconsistencies.
Yeah, if you look at the whole picture.
Right, and it took years for them to really do that.
It did.
And unfortunately, it was too late for Claire.
An excellent liar.
Yeah.
And a believable liar.
Apparently. So there were two excellent sources that we used for this episode.
One's an amazing book called The Black Widower, The Life and Crimes of a Sociopathic Killer, that was written by Charles Lavery. It's a very detailed book, especially with the investigations and trial of Malcolm Webster. Then there is a BBC miniseries that you can find on Amazon streaming called The Widower. And like most things BBC, it's a very well done documentary.
Yeah, that's something I would have watched. Even if we weren't doing this case, I would have just watched it for pure entertainment. Because BBC does some great miniseries.
They do.
And the whole story, it's a true story, but it's shocking.
Well, it's almost unbelievable, isn't it?
It is, really. So, which makes it very entertaining, I have to admit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think that sums up Malcolm Webster. Before we go to feedback, I would just like to remind our listeners who aren't TIGRABBER members that it might be something for them to do. TIGRABBER members are our primary support for our podcasts, and we recently released an episode on the Craigslist killer, Philip Markoff, that I thought was very good. We included some edited interviews with Philip and his fiancée with the Boston Police. Now, we consistently release a members-only episode at least once a month, and we put quite a bit of effort into these episodes, just as we do with our primary episodes. To have access, you can join for $3 or $5 a month on our website, tigrabber.com. Our members receive some True Crime Brewery gifts from us, and our undying admiration. If you're interested, just go to tigrabber.com and sign up to support us, or you can go to Patreon, and you can hear our premium members there as a patron. You can also support us by making a purchase through our Shop the Brewery page on our website, or by giving us a positive review on iTunes or wherever you listen to our podcasts. Our Design a True Crime Brewery t-shirt contest is just finishing up in a day or two, so if you have an entry, please get it to us at truecrimebrewery@tigrabber.com or through a direct message on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook. So what we'd like is your artwork in a JPG or PNG format. Something with two or three colors is preferable, but we've got some great entries now, and we're definitely considering new ones that come in. I think as the deadline approaches, we're getting a couple every day, so people are really getting into it.
Yeah, people want to hit the deadline.
And if you don't know, the winner gets $250 plus one of the t-shirts. So that's pretty cool. I think it's worth a few minutes of work.
Don't you?
Yeah.
Let's do it. Oh, I can't enter, though,
can I? You can't enter now. So we're taking the first week of February off, and there's going to be a week without a True Crime Brewery episode. This is our first break since we began the podcast back in May of 2016. So it's feels a little weird to us, but I think it's a well-deserved break we're looking forward to. Now, as you might know, CrimeCon is coming up May 4th through 6th in Nashville. And I'm going to announce now that we're going to have a table on Podcast Row for the first time. So we're super excited and honestly a little bit nervous. So I'm really hoping some of our listeners will come so we aren't just sitting there alone like the lonely kid at a junior high dance. I really need some positive support. If you use our promo code TCBrewery when buying your ticket for CrimeCon, you get 10% off admission too. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I've never been to it, but some pretty famous people are going to be there, like Nancy Grace, the actor who plays Jokenda, the young Jokenda.
Really?
Yeah, he's going to be there. And of course, lots of true crime podcasters who we've never met. So
that'll be interesting.
I'm really excited.
I'm looking forward to trying some Nashville breweries and brew pubs.
Oh, well, yes.
And I think we can maybe have informal meetings there, too.
Oh, yeah. We'll definitely be meeting up with some listeners at some bars around Nashville.
Yeah.
Dick's doing his research now to plan on where to get the best beer. So I hope a lot of you will turn up. Now, please write in and share your ideas and opinions with us. And you can share your opinions on our True Crime Brewery fan discussion page on Facebook as well. We have some really amazing listeners who go to the discussions page and share some great stuff, and they actually know a lot more about a lot of these crimes than we do. So it's really fun stuff to read and to participate in. So that's all I have to say, Dick. Why don't we read the feedback?
Okay. So I'm going to do some corrections that have been pointed out by our loyal listeners. Number one, the Menendez brothers are brothers, not twins. I can't remember that we called them twins, but I guess we apparently
either,
did.
I can't either, but 4 or 5 people have told me this, and we must have said that in our episode. Or actually, we didn't do an episode on them, so it must have been in feedback where we mentioned that.
Right.
But yeah, I didn't think they were twins, but we must have said it.
Somewhere.
Somewhere we said it, because people aren't going to let us live that down, so I thought we better acknowledge that now, that they're brothers, not twins.
Right. Another listener pointed out that the Carnation Christmas murders, where we said that Michelle and Joseph got the death penalty, they in fact got life without parole. Now, in our defense, that was when we were trying to get multiple episodes out in addition to doing our weekly shows. And
yeah.
Wikipedia didn't do very well by us. But then we have one more. On August 4th, 1892, Andrew and Abby Borden were found murdered in their home. Lizzie was arrested and tried for the Axe murders. She was acquitted in 1893 and continued to live in Fall River until her death in June of 1927. Now, apparently we mentioned in feedback that Lizzie killed her mother, but we failed to mention that she killed her father also.
All right, thanks, Dick. I have a letter from Natalie from Los Angeles, and she shared with us an article written by Jordan Davis's mom in 2017. And that was our latest episode, Trigger Happy, The Murder of Jordan Davis, where he was killed for the loud music by the older white guy in the car next to him. So Jordan's mom has been pretty active, politically active. And this is a great article that she wrote. So I'm just going to read it. It's not very long.
No, but it's a good letter.
Yeah. Over 4 years ago, my 17-year-old son, Jordan Davis, was senselessly shot and killed in a dispute over loud music at a Jacksonville gas station. At trial, my son's killer cited Florida's Stand Your Ground law as defense for taking the life of my only child. Since that day, I have found myself in the trenches with other gun violence prevention advocates, fighting to change dangerous gun laws that leave many of us vulnerable to gun violence. In October 2015, I testified before Florida's Senate Judiciary Committee against a bill that would have expanded the state's already deadly Stand Your Ground law. Although the bill died a swift death, some lawmakers determined to place special interests over public safety have reintroduced it this year. Just as it would have done in 2015, this bill would effectively require defendants who raise stand-your-ground defenses to be convicted twice. It would be a gross miscarriage of justice for families like mine. Reckless laws like Stand Your Ground create a shoot-first, ask-questions-later culture in Florida, which emboldens everyday civilians to act as vigilantes. They encourage and empower people, like the man who shot and killed my son, to forego peaceful solutions to everyday disputes and instead reach for a gun. These laws go so far as to grant untrained civilians more leeway to shoot than the U.S. military gives soldiers in a war zone. Allowing Stand Your Ground to exist and expand would only further promote a society where threats and fear rule. We cannot allow this culture to be perpetuated in Florida. Research has shown that states with Stand Your Ground laws see more homicides, and Florida is no exception. Florida's Stand Your Ground law has been linked to 32% increase in firearm homicides, while homicides considered justifiable tripled. So I just wanted to thank Natalie for that. I don't think we have to say anything more about it. We've already given our opinions.
I don't think we have anything else we need to say about that.
No.
Okay, I have a letter from Brittany Joe. Says, I was new to podcasts and a friend mentioned true crime. I had listened to a podcast on iHeartRadio as another approach to making a murderer. I loved it. I looked up more podcasts in this genre and found you. You were my first podcast that I listened to every week. I've since been listening for about a year and a half now. I have to say that your podcasts have always been great and they seem to be getting better. You didn't want me to say that part, right?
No, just read the highlighted part.
Your latest podcast, Adopt a Wife, had me truly disturbed. Poor Suzanne, who was taken away from her mother and then went through everything Franklin Floyd put her through, truly defied the odds. Whereas he was one that passed the abuse on to others that he had endured, she was one that really left a footprint on the world in a beautiful way. Then she has a recommendation. She says she knows that Oba Chandler has been recommended to us before. It's really a sad and disturbing case, and she'd like to recommend it again. The mother and two sisters endured some horrible assaults while on vacation. The poor father was at home and never saw his family again. You two are always so sensitive when it comes to victims, and I really like how you bring the story to light. I think you should again consider doing this case.
Okay. Well, we are doing that case, right?
We are. It's a horrible case. It's a sadistic case, but yes, we're going to do it. So thank you, Brittany Joe. And then she's talking about beer trades and stuff, which if we do another beer for a Colorado case, we'll do something.
Okay. So I got an update from Alana on Dellen Millard and Paul Smitsch. Remember, they're the two with the killing of Tim Bosma.
Right.
They were tried and convicted. Well, Millard was just tried and convicted of killing the girlfriend, Laura Babcock, and he acted as his own lawyer, thinking he could convince the jury that he was right. He's a real sociopath. And also, he's going to be going to trial for his father's murder next. So that continues to be an ongoing story.
It does.
Yep. And then Audra wrote to me, well, first she had corrected me about Lyle and Eric not being twins, just being brothers. That's another one. But then the main thing I wanted to say from her was that she said, being a true crime fanatic, I know of at least 100 cases of matricide. I believe the rarest of all murders within a family is for the daughter to kill her father only, so not both of her parents. So she's a huge fan of the show Deadly Women, and that's an ID. And she thinks we'd love that show because it chronicles only female killers. Now, I looked up some crime statistics because I think we'd said it was really rare for a girl to kill a parent, but it's actually the most rare for a girl to kill her father.
Yeah, I guess I could intuitively figure that.
Yeah, kind of. So I just have a few statistics that I found, and they're from Australia. So it says one parent a month is killed by their child. It's a crime few of us could comprehend, but it happens more than you might think. So, investigators continued to probe the alleged murder of AFL coach Phil Walsh by his son, Cy. The tragedy has shed light on an area of family violence we don't often think about, when children are charged with turning violent against their parents. So, one parent is killed by their child every month in Australia, according to figures from the Australian Institute of Criminology. A May 2015 report by the Institute found parents were the third most frequent group of victims of family homicides, and that's behind partners and children. So siblings are even behind that.
Huh.
Between 2002 and 2003 and 2011 and 2012, 134 parents were murdered by their children. So that is known as parricide, if you kill your parents. 10 incidents resulted in the deaths of both parents. By the way of comparison, 354 people were murdered by their domestic partner in the same period, and 238 children were killed by their parent or parents. There were 40 victims of sibling homicide between 2002 and 2012. The vast majority of murdered parents, 88%, were killed in their family home, and in most cases between 6 p.m. and midnight. 4 were killed in someone else's home. Another 4 were killed in a health or mental care facility. Sons were the most likely to murder a parent, with 80% of offenders being male, and in 73% of these cases, the victims were stabbed to death. Samantha Bricknell, research manager at the Australian Institute of Criminology, said those factors, the sex of the offender, the location, and the cause of death, meant in many ways parricides were generally statistically consistent with most other forms of homicide in Australia. But a closer look at the statistics points an even more grim picture of these crimes. So while predominantly the offender is male, and predominantly the victim is a male, they did find that in earlier analysis in 2003, the usual circumstantial thing is sons killing their fathers and daughters killing their mothers. So I thought that was really interesting.
Same sex, right?
Yep, right. So if we remember that homicide more generically, it's men as victims, but a son is potentially more likely to inflict damage when he's up against another male figure. Most sons and daughters who kill their parents are 18 to 49, according to the Institute's statistics. Some are younger, and there are some who are even older. There's a lot of focus on the 18 to 34-year age group, but when you're looking at 40-year-old men or 70-year-old men who are killing their dads, it isn't that much more unusual. We also don't have a lot of multiple homicides in the sense that you have multiple victims or multiple offenders. But what's interesting is you have a slightly higher proportion of multiple victims with parricides. And I think what the temptation is, mom coming in and defending the dad, and then both of them end up
both
being killed.
Good. Yeah.
Yeah. An earlier report into family homicides released in 2003 found domestic arguments were the most common motive for killing a parent, where a motive had been established. So 9% of these murders were revenge killings. Ms. Bricknell also said that while parricide could be motivated by abuse a child suffered at their parent, it's really difficult to determine the motivations behind these killings. So she said, I think with any domestic homicide, there's a whole range of reasons that may be in place that charge the particular event, long-seated issues as well as spontaneous things. Because the pattern isn't so different from other kinds of homicide, I think we have to realize, and this is the tragedy in any kind of violence, a lot of it occurs for very banal reasons. And that's why I don't want to say that in every kind of parricide there must have been some sort of physical abuse or some kind of traumatic event that occurred to that particular individual to go ahead and kill their parent. So it might have just been a stupid argument that gets out of control, especially if drugs and alcohol are involved. That can happen. And that's really the tragedy of it. I mean, a lot of them probably could have been stopped, but it's just this combination of factors that leads to these horrible events. So, it does seem that the most unusual, in summary, is a girl killing her father.
Well, I think the numbers are probably pretty tiny anyway, right?
Seems like it. Well, they said 88% were male against either or both parents, right?
Right.
So, a girl killing her father must be pretty small.
Down the list there, right?
And can I think of any like that off the top of my head? Of a girl just killing her dad?
Just the dad, not both parents.
Yeah. I'm having trouble even thinking of one. So maybe if someone knows of one, you can tell me.
We'll have to look.
Yeah. I mean, my mind wants to think of maybe a girl who was abused by her dad that struck out.
Mm-hmm.
But then I'm just falling into the whole category in the letter.
Right.
Yeah.
You are. So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's all I'm sharing for feedback.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks for the discussion. And we'll talk to everybody later at the Quiet Ed.
All right. Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.